Thank you, Dhammaloka. Well, yes, this is the eighth talk, and it feels like a sort of huge number of ideas that you could just digest, spend such a lot of time digesting. And it's been really interesting because I've been working on this a little bit while I've been absorbing the other talks, which is not necessarily a strategy I'd choose to do again, actually, but the advantage is that it has had that sort of integrating effect on what I'm going to say, I think. So meeting the suffering of the world, compassion in action. This is a bit of a favourite subject of mine. So I was quite young when I realised that many people didn't have their basic needs. They didn't have food, water, housing, safety, let alone education or healthcare. I think I was about nine because I remember the house I was living in, and I was watching, must have been one of those sort of Open University documentaries. I don't know why a nine-year-old was parked in front of one of them, but I was. And I was watching this documentary about the slums around a city it was a South American city, I can't remember which one. And I just remember being really shocked by that. And later, through a lot of study and a lot of contacts with activists from all over the world in the intervening time, I found out that this was unnecessary deprivation, that there was gratuitous cruelty in the world, and also mindless destruction of natural beauty. And how can I find peace of mind when I know this? You know, it's like the sort of curse of our age in a way that we know the scale of this suffering and it's kind of coming at us in a way all the time. No other generation has really had to live with the sort of amount of information about suffering that we have. So I came to Buddhism wanting to know what teachings, what perspectives could help me understand these issues, and looking for something that could guide me to make the choice between all the different sort of responses I could make to what I'd learned. So encountering the Dharma and practicing meditation, I then found out that these outward problems of greed, hatred and delusion were also aspects of my own mind. They were reflected inside my own mind. And maybe the reason why these problems existed was that they were the collective manifestation of negative mental states of many people throughout history. And this put a different complexion on things and challenged my superficial analysis of the bad guys that was them and the good guys that was us. This did change something. So I also became more aware of my own suffering and the need to include myself in the circle of metta. And this changed something too, and possibly in a more of an important way. I think it gave my activity much more of an ethical base in that it was less based on horrified anxiety. So that term will be familiar to a lot of you in that it's the traditional near enemy, i.e. it can be easily confused with compassion, but actually is really the complete opposite. So if I included myself, I could work as an ally, as someone collaborating in a shared process of liberation, rather than someone sort of being a good Buddhist, you know, trying to be helpful and to fix something for those poor people over there. So there was a quote which actually I came across pre my contact with Buddhism, but I was very struck by, and I think I've used it as a sort of touchstone in the since. And it was by an Aboriginal woman, an activist called Leela Watson. And she says, if you have come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is tied up with mine, then let us work together. So I think Dharma practice has enabled me to shift my approach to an activity based on friendship and solidarity that she calls for in that quote. So I still have those two linked questions. You know, how can I liberate myself from the suffering I experience, my negative mental states? And holding this question in a dynamic relationship with the question, how can the Dharma speak to those social, ecological questions, the mess we're in as a society as species and as part of the global ecosystem. So, initially, I want to explore this statement a little bit. Another way of putting the transforming self and world would be personal and social transformation are indivisible. And I think I first heard that really sort of spoken by Loka Mitra, actually, at an order gathering. And this is certainly Bhante's perspective. And I want to share with you some initial work in progress thoughts based on a piece of research I did last year. When I say research, this makes it sound a bit grand. It was kind of a bit of a little poll, but I'll tell you about it. And I wanted to know what that statement, personal social transformation are indivisible, I wanted to know what it meant to a sort of spectrum of people. So I'm going to start with looking at that a little bit. And after that, I'm going to talk about a very specific example of something I'm involved in here at the Birmingham Buddhist Centre, which is the Carers Project, and reflect on lessons learned about that a bit. And finally, I'll round up with some challenges that come out of that work and from other experience and sort of more widely. So that's the kind of menu, as it were. Those are the three bits. That's where I'm going. So this first section, what does it mean personal and social transformation are indivisible? Well, I really enjoyed when Vajragupta did that, presented the sort of effect, the research he'd done on the 22 websites, because it really sort of based it in something a bit more objective. So I could sort of waffle on about what I think people understand by this term, but actually I can share with you a topic, a bit of research that was done with, I think it was 297 Buddhists, about what they think about that statement, what they understand by it. So just to fill in a bit of background, I was doing some work alongside the Karuna Trust, and we were looking for funding to do some awareness-raising work about socially engaged Buddhism in Asia. And when I don't know if some of you have experience of these funding applications, but they like you to really sort of evidence the need for this and the interest in these kinds of things before they give you any money. And so we set up an online survey and asked a number of questions, and this was one of them. So this happened over a period of about a month, last November. And as I say, we got 297 replies, and 77% of those were from the FWBO, and the rest were from several other traditions, including Zen and Theravadan and so on. So the options are, first of all, we asked them the simple question, personal and social transformation are indivisible. Do you agree? Yes, no, sort of. Right. So 64% said yes, 27% said sort of, and 9% said no. So the vast majority are saying yes or sort of. So you probably have to allow for the fact that this went out to a network of fairly warm people to Karuna's work. So it might be a bit higher than a more random sample of Buddhists. Having said that, when I read the further question, I think some of the people who'd said no had misunderstood the question because they seemed to then be arguing the yes. But anyway. But I think what was interesting about that was I think actually the reason for that was that English wasn't their first language and they were answering from India. And although these polls, you know, kind of have their disadvantages, actually to be able to get some responses from India and from Hungary as well as across Europe was really interesting. So the next question, we asked them to explain the reason for their response. And what I really noticed was that when asked to explain their reason, most of them described it in terms of the effect of personal practice on society. So personal practice was the cause, effect on the society was the effect. That was the kind of bulk of the explanation. So the argument being that as individuals make up society, and because of interconnectedness, our personal change brings about a wider change. Well, you know, I've got no argument with that at all. That's completely, I'd completely agree. People were strongly of the view that you have to start with the self, and without self-awareness, real social change was impossible. So some people put it quite strongly in terms of having to get yourself sorted out first, and that does, in a way that you could, putting it very crudely, you could say that that sort of dynamic of how far you have to sort of purify your own mental states and motives before you actually go and engage is a bit of a debate that's gone all the way through the history of Buddhism, isn't it? So one person put it like this: I believe it's important from a Buddhist point of view to transform one's consciousness and how one views issues such as suffering, poverty, social justice and education before embarking on social work projects. So it did surprise me a bit that this view that the effect of society, the effect on society, was only an accumulation of individual changes was so dominant in the answers. Because though, of course, it's a completely legitimate answer, it did make me wonder if we've articulated a sort of broader range of understandings, because Bhante certainly has. I did quite a bit of research on Bhante's writings and thinking on this, helped a lot by a number of talks I've begged Parami for, because she, I think, has a sort of encyclopedic version of this, because I was contributing to a new module for the Mitra study course called Interconnected World, which is now up and available if you're interested in this sort of area. There is this whole 8-week module on this kind of area. So another way in, less of the people who responded to this, but still a significant subsection, talked about it in terms of social action being the fruit of personal practice, the sort of logical consequence of personal practice. So it makes you more sensitive to suffering and more inclined to want to respond. So someone put this really strongly, as if they almost sort of saw it as being compelled to act. So they said, through my practice, I have gained a deeper understanding and experience of interconnectedness, so that it has become impossible for me not to engage with issues in this world. Okay, so another angle from another few people. Some people brought out the effect of society on us as individuals, looking at the statement from the other end, in a way. So Bhante explains this. I came across this the other day, this really fascinating metaphor of the lotus in the toxic mire. Some of you will know that one. I'll read the quote so that you can get the context of it. But interestingly, in regard to what we've been hearing about over the past few days in the talks, he said this in relation to right livelihood. So this actually comes from a lecture series called The Ideal Society, which was given in 1968. So it's right at the beginning. So I'll just read you this quote. With right livelihood, we are concerned with the transformation of the collective life. Not just the individual life, but the collective life, the life of the community, the life of society, if you like, even the life of the state. Now, this is not an aspect of Buddhism which is usually very much emphasized. In fact, sometimes it is rather played down. But it is very definitely a part of the total teaching. This idea that we should try to transform also not just our individual lives, but the community, society at large, the world, the state. One has to make or try to make some effort to transform the society in the midst of which one lives. And then here's the metaphor. It's all very well to talk about the lotus blooming in the midst of the mire, but it's very difficult to be a lotus when the mire is particularly nasty or particularly all-pervasive. So that's a number of people's responses kind of reflected that kind of way of looking at things. So then there was a group which talked about the sort of reinforcing relationship between, or augmenting relationship between personal and social transformation. So here's a couple. One said, transformation, whether of self or society, does have some merit, even if not as effective as would be the case if the two went hand in hand. So that sort of sense of that, you know, good job it's videoed, because if it was audio it wouldn't work, would it? But yeah, that sort of mutual reinforcement. I don't know if I can put it any differently. And somebody else put a similar idea in a different way. Personal transformation inevitably affects those around me, but the effect will be greater if I'm more conscious of social objectives. Then there was the whole idea about kind of personal transformation getting stuck, and Bhante has certainly warned about this quite energetically. So this person puts it like this. I believe that to an extent people can develop personally without this extending further and instigating social development. But at a certain stage in a person's development, there must be an element of social transformation in order to continue personal transformation. So, yeah, that was... I'm still thinking about these ones, really. So a lot of people express the view that activism doesn't necessarily lead to personal transformation. And I think that's, you know, the critique. In a way, that's what Buddhism has got to offer, what the Dharma's got to offer to the activist world, is this sense that there's a personal and a social aspect to everything. And if you go in with unawareness, it can make the situation worse and just sort of perpetuate the same old patterns. So that was quite well reflected. So one way I've heard this is talked about in terms of the institutional greed, hatred and delusion, which Parami mentioned the other day and developed a bit in the question and answer session we had. So these are greed, hatred and delusion expressed as at a societal level. So you could say mindless consumerism, what was the sort of Tesco syndrome, as Subhuti was putting it on the first night. Mindless consumerism and materialism that is the manifestation of greed. Aggressive militarism, maybe as an example, is a manifestation of aversion, hatred. And sensationalized media and celebrity obsession, possibly, represents institutionalized delusion. So there's probably lots of other examples, so that's my favorite one. So the point is that these aspects in society supercharge our mental states, particularly greed and materialism, because we're just bombarded by advertising all the time, and it sort of seeps into your consciousness, doesn't it? Even if you don't watch the telly, it kind of gets in there. It's very difficult to be conscious of that. So, finally, I just wanted to... and this is the kind of link to the whole of the next bit. There was a very small minority of people expressing a point of view I was expecting to see more emphasized. So their comments had a sense that the work to transform society is in itself a personally transforming process. So it's the practice of the novice bodhisattva. It's a practice in itself. And I was really surprised that that wasn't really there, actually. And even the people who did mention it didn't really go into it very much. I mean, they were sort of grasping at it with phrases like, helping others is a way to be less concerned with self, or if we focus on being more aware and metaful to others, the more we will transform our own hearts. You know, they were sort of going into that area. And it did remind me of a story. It was a book actually by a guy called Fleet Moore, who is an American Buddhist teacher. And he's got a really extraordinary story, because actually he was incarcerated in the American prison system with a very long sentence. I think he was caught drug smuggling or drug dealing or something. Anyway, he got a long sentence and he ended up in this prison. And he started a hospice project, and he set up a whole project around prisoners sitting with the dying and being involved in the befriending of people who were dying. And what he noticed about that was how much of a change it had on the prisoner, how much of an effect it had, what a transforming effect it had on the prisoners to be involved in something altruistic. Because a lot of the other things that happened to them, and mostly that wasn't very much in terms of rehabilitation, but what there was very psychologically orientated, very personal, very, you know, how are you going to sort of, you know, move forward in... And the trouble, he noticed that what effect that had was that it kind of exacerbated their narcissism and their sort of self-preoccupation and their self-pity. Whereas in relation to the altruistic work with the prison, with the hospice, it seemed to have this transforming effect. And I suppose that was kind of what I mean. So I'm understanding metta, maitri, to be a dynamic thing. After all, the first precept is, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. So I was kind of a bit surprised that the separation of working on myself, my practice, was seen in such a different category as social transformation. And there were a few really funny responses under the no category, which were things like, you know, I see absolutely no relevance to this to my practice at all. You know, or I do not submit, what was one of them? I do not support glib, simplistic statements of this kind. Things that people write in these anonymous spaces are quite funny. But actually, overall, I was just really impressed with the care that people had gone to try and, as I've read some of the quotes, you know, they'd really tried to sort of explore what they understood by this. So I was extremely grateful to about 295 of them. Yeah. So a final category, I said final before anyway, the last final category, it's becoming a bit like Welsh Hills, isn't it, when you get to the top and there's another one to go. So the last bit was somebody sort of talked about testing the Dharma out, and I quite like this one actually. They said, contributing to the world will both, I hope, make the world a better place and test me in my understanding and compassion so far. So it's that idea of being reflected back by trying something out. Okay, so I'm going to just summarise. That's a lot of different ideas there. I'm just going to summarise that for people who whose heads might be frying a bit by now. So you could say that people understood that if individuals change, society changes as a consequence of interconnectedness. They also see social transformation as the fruit of practice. And maybe without it, it is sometimes possible to get stuck in an over-personalised approach to practice. So Bhante certainly warned about this. Then there is the effect of our cultural social environment, which can supercharge our negative mental states and provide conditions which are not conducive to practice. And then there is the benefit of altruistic work, which can loosen our self-preoccupation and give us another context to test out our understanding of the Dharma so far. So that would be the sort of very broad sort of summary. But actually, because this, all this, these raw comments, actually, I can imagine working with this for quite a while, sort of pulling out the implications. So I suppose why I wanted to go into this was the point I'm trying to make, really, is that this analysis, the survey and the sort of very provisional analysis I've done of it, points to what the current understanding actually is and what's missing and where we might want to strengthen our message. But it's not only about the message, it's about how we create opportunities of the lived experience of altruistic workers' practice. So, it sort of gives us some pointers of what's not being communicated, perhaps, in our teaching, since 77% of this group were from the FWBO. So that's the kind of first bit about the research, and now I'm going to go into a very practical example, so the tone's going to change completely. And I want to turn to an example of altruistic workers' practice, which is the Carers Stress Management Project at the Birmingham Buddhist Centre. So this is an example of how a group of friends, Mitras and Order members in Birmingham have been able to offer something, and actually it's sort of like more meet a need. This project came out of an expression of the carers of the city that this is the kind of thing they needed and wanted, and Birmingham met that. The idea was first developed in Manchester, and then we sort of learned the model, and it now happens in Brighton and the LBC and Manchester and here. That's all. So this group of people, carers, suffer a great deal of stress, isolation, in health, and often poverty. So I'll give you a bit of an overview of the project first. So we organise weekend breaks, we call them. They're retreats, weekend retreats, really, for 100 carers a year in the countryside, usually in these big sort of Christian diocesan houses. We haven't got a sort of Rivendell or anything nearby. These are unpaid carers, so they're not professional care workers. They're family, caring for family members. And about a third of them look after children with disabilities. They have a lot of health needs of their own, so statistically, carers have twice the physical and mental health problems that you'd expect for their demographic, which only goes to show how hard caring is, you know, 24-hour-a-day thing. Many of them, we asked them on the form when they last had an overnight break, and I never really quite get over the shock of reading how often someone says something like 15 years. You know, like a few years is perfectly normal. 15 to 20 years even, it crops up. It's extraordinary. Some of them look after more than one person. About a third of them are from black and minority ethnic groups, Gujarati community, Chinese community, African Caribbean communities particularly. And they practice other faiths, and they're working class and middle class, and they're mostly women. And the retreats are free, and everything's paid for them, including the transport. So we also do several days during the year at the centre, and they can come back and do more yoga and meditation. And they can come to as many of these as they like. And we've also recently produced a CD with a little booklet so they can take that home. So most of them only come once, not because they don't want to come again. They're desperate to come again. They all say they want to, but because there's such an overwhelming... we're completely swamped by applications every year. I've got mountains of paper upstairs of people wanting to come. So now and again we can arrange for people to come back. They fill last-minute places, and now and again we do a retreat for them, but on the whole they come once. And that's one of the challenges of this, actually. Because we know, you know, we come and we learn and we go on year after year with loads of support, and, you know, what are we really offering? And I think that's a huge challenge. So we're looking at that in sorts of different ways. So it also provides an income to the centre to the tune of several thousand pounds a year. This is City Council funded, Birmingham City Council, they pay about 30,000 a year to the centre. It's a right livelihood. It could be a right livelihood for a bigger team, but I get paid to administer it, and the teachers very generously donate the money back to the centre for the time that's budgeted for them. So that's how it works. So our understanding of this is that we create like a kind of sangha where people can step into So there's five of us who work together quite regularly. And we teach a pretty standard program of meditation and yoga, qigong, some massage workshops. I mean, the meditation we teach and the way we teach it, you would recognize from any center anywhere in the UK, FWBO, down the line. And that's what it's, you know, that's what worked. We've done it over and over, and it just works really well. So they're also in the countryside, and being in nature and going for walks is really important too. So these weekends are completely mysterious. They shouldn't actually work, really, if you think about it. You know, a bunch of people, they're really stressed. They're suffering from all sorts of illnesses, physical and mental. They've got virtually nothing in common with each other apart from being carers, or us. They turn up nervous. They're feeling guilty, almost all of them, for leaving the person they care for. They're really anxious. And we take them away for the weekend, and what happens? Well, some carers in the final circle, when we do a reporting out, they're in tears about it. You know, how much they've got out of it, their gratitude. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And the evaluations they do at the end, we've never had less than like 96% or something. And they talk about feeling relaxed, having enjoyed it, and having a break, and meeting other carers, which is kind of what you'd expect, wouldn't you? But they also say this. I'm just going to read some quotes from what they say on the forms that they fill in at the end. The weekend soothed my soul and gave me the strength to cope again. It gave me recognition for my efforts, made me feel thanked and treasured and appreciated. Someone else said, I can go back and concentrate on being positive rather than negative. And another one, I really don't feel so alone and afraid. Gives me more strength to go on. And finally, someone said, I found myself again. So there's something really going on there, isn't there? There's something going on. So we don't teach the Dharma explicitly, in that we don't say the Buddha taught that, da, 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 da. But I must say, in every other interaction, I'm interacting with people as I would on a retreat, and I don't find it in any way less satisfying, and I don't find it superficial actually either. I don't find myself going, oh, I better not go there because these people haven't come to learn Buddhism. You know, it just isn't like that. One of them once said to me, she took me aside in a very hushed tone. She said, I think it's only the Buddhists who could do a project like this. So I want to tell you a few stories to give you a flavour of this. And I'm not going to comment on them very much, actually. I'm just going to tell them as stories, because I was quite struck by what Dharmarati said, is that you can actually sort of rob the mystery of these things by sort of overanalyzing them. So I just want to tell you some stories. So Andrea. So Andrea was a young parent with a disabled child, and she looked really anxious and very sullen and very tight when she arrived all of the first evening. And unbeknown to her, her room was adjacent to my room and with a very thin wall. And she got onto her mobile phone, and I'd have to bleep the whole conversation. She was furious. I beeping well want to go home. I hate it. I hate them. Look what I've got to do. And she parodied the whole program all the way through. You know, and then at 6 o'clock we do this, and 7 o'clock we do that, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not going to get any rest at all. And she was really angry. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll keep a bit of an eye on her tomorrow. So she went to the meditation in the morning, and you know some of those people who just really take to it? She was one of them. She just got so completely into the meditation, she loved it. And she fell in love with this blue blanket, because we take these with us. And this started to be symbolize something of sort of safety and comfort and peace and something. And she started quite early in the weekend asking if she could take one home, which I must admit, it was Kev here, yeah, I must admit I let her. So she was really enthusiastic. She started to brighten and so on. And then I think it was on the Sunday, she came up to me and said, do you know, at home, usually, actually, I swear quite a lot. And I had to kind of go, oh, I sort of chose to go, oh, do you? Oh. And really. And she said, and it was just so down the line, she just said, actually, I don't think it's good for me. I don't think it's good for my kids. And I notice that you don't. You all don't. And I'm going to stop doing it when I go home. And that was it. End of conversation. But I just thought, you know, like kind of homeopathic speech presets kind of going in. It's amazing. So she's still out there with a blue blanket somewhere. So Sue, and now I'm sort of looking at it really sort of from the point of view of the effect of them on us. Sue was quite a young woman and she had very serious health problems. She had a carer herself who she hadn't brought with her to the weekend. And I think if I'd known how unwell she was, I think I would have, I just didn't know basically, couldn't get the information. Because we were in a very remote place and basically she'd had a motorbike accident and she had a head injury and the head injury had caused the kind of epilepsy just wasn't under control. And during the weekend she had multiple fits, which is extremely dangerous. And we called the paramedics and they came and went. And to be within calling distance of her or just to be able to hear if anything else happened, I slept in the room next to hers overnight. And it was a very sort of intimate kind of situation. And in the morning, I got up to meditate early. And my sadhana practice, my visualization practice, is Amogha Siddhi, who's associated with fearlessness. And I had, and he's quite elusive. He doesn't really turn up that often, actually, when I want him to. I mean, when I do the thing, the practice, the sadhana. But he was so incredibly vivid that morning in that her courage of living with her dangerous health situation with such joyfulness and buoyancy and, just positivity. And she was incredible. She really made such a huge impression on me. I don't know how she is now, but... that was really quite something. On the same weekend was Kevin. And Kevin was had a bit of a drink problem. And that we were in one of those Christian retreat centres. I don't know why they have bars, but they had a bar. And it was one of these trust bars, you know, where you could just help yourself. And I noticed that there was this little sort of swing bin, which was about this high. And it started to sort of fill up with all these empty tins, you know, sort of overflowed and onto the floor with all these tins. And then the carers came to me and they were getting quite upset because he was getting more and more drunk. So I asked a member of the team, Shantistana, who does a lot of the teaching of the meditation, almost all of it on these weekends. And I asked him to go and see what was going on. And there was this farcical moment, actually, because I went over and there's a kind of resident vicar who wears a dog collar. And me and the vicar, it was one of these completely sort of farcical situations, me and the vicar were taking all these tins off the shelf and trying to sort of shove them in a cupboard, you know, and sort of like just get rid of the temptation kind of thing. While we were doing that, missing hundreds of them, I couldn't believe how many tins of beer there were. So while we were doing that, Shantistana had gone in to where Kevin was, and I went through the door, and there they were, Kevin still with a tin in his hand, and Shantistana and another member of the team sitting either side. And they were just with him. You know, it was just a sort of open-minded, relaxed friendship, you know. And I realized that my reaction, and it was a reaction, was take it off him, get him away from the carers, get him to bed, you know, quite a sort of averse kind of anti-energy. But they'd just gone in and it was working, you know, they were just with him and not created confrontation. It was brilliant. And it's just really amazing to sort of be in these situations of teams. I mean, we experience it, don't we, when we're leading retreats and so on, these kinds of adventures crop up as well. But it's just really, talk about work as practice, you know, it's a really lovely way to be working with other Sangha members. So I want to pull out a few points about this. So logically, these weekends should be exhausting. So there's a lot of people experiencing a lot of suffering in their life. It's a lot of responsibility, a lot of logistics. But I feel really rejuvenated by them. I don't come away feeling tired. It's like a sort of weekend long metabhavana, in a way. That's how I often describe it. And I have run a lot of community projects and these kinds of residentials, and they do tire me out, but these don't. And I think the meditation holds it together, actually. And it really gives me faith to see that what we can do in meeting the needs of this group, it really, that's the pith of it, really. It strengthens my confidence in the three jewels. It strengthens my going for refuge. If we were practicing something that addressed the needs of a subsection of society, people who had the sort of conditions which enable them to walk through that front door, then that would be brilliant. That would be fine. That would be enough. But the real energy flow of my commitment, I think, is to see that it really is all beings that this speaks to, as in any beings. The inclusive nature of it, the universality of it, is what really inspires me. I think that's where my sort of fuel is, if you like. This is a bit of a health warning on this bit, because this is really raw thinking, right? And I'd be interested in feedback on it as well. But I've just been thinking recently about who's giving what to whom. So I was quite struck by Subhuti saying that the Dharma is the kind of natural order of the universe. You know, it's not a set of words and ideas. It's kind of, it's how things are, like gravity. And when we go do the final go-round of the carers project, a lot of the team often say that they feel very privileged to have worked with the carers. And these are very compassionate people, and they have a lot of patience and a lot of generosity and a lot of love, really, to do what they do. They couldn't survive, they couldn't do what they do unless they did. And it almost feels more like going in with an attitude of, where is the Dharma at work here? Do you see what I mean? About rather than injecting something that isn't there, bringing something from somewhere, it's more like, well, how do we clear some space for something to be recognised and celebrated and affirmed that's already kind of working, rather than let's go and do some Dharma with them kind of thing. So where is the Dharma at work here? So this work like everything we do can be a practice. But it's something about integrating consciously that social and personal transformation. It creates a very powerful synergy. And it feels as if we're just beginning to discover what the potential is in terms of reaching beyond into the community to people who wouldn't particularly be attracted by the Buddhism label. So I want to go on to three challenges. I've got time for three challenges. There's definitely two I want to... Yeah, no, maybe I'll just do two of these to do them justice. So the two challenges, I'd say, one of them I call the wise warning syndrome. So I do think there's a bit of a tendency when activists and out there orientated people come into contact with Buddhist sanghas, and I don't necessarily just mean the FWBO. I think actually we're probably better than a lot, and I do have contact with other sanghas, so that isn't total speculation. But when they come into contact with us, they sort of met by quite a lot of wise warnings. And they are wise warnings in that, you know, there is validity in them. But people might say to them things like, passion might indicate some attachment to views, and there's a danger of building an identity around being active and being needed. And compassionate action is pointless without wisdom, and you need to get yourself sorted out a bit first, and all of those things. And, you know, fair enough, it is good advice, but I don't want to meet people like that, actually. I don't want it just with that. I want it to kind of, I think Vajragupta was touching on this area as well a bit. I want to, well, at least balance encouragement with a bit of, you know, wise warning. So I don't want to problematize their enthusiasm and their energy. Maybe this is their glimpse of a glimpse of perfect vision. Maybe it's a breaking of their particular bit of Avalokiteshvara's heart. I don't know. I'd like to be able to start from encouragement and honoring that in them. And the wise warnings have their place, of course, but in balance with encouragement. So, okay, I'm going to go for this bit, actually. And I wondered about this, because this is a very extreme story, and maybe we can pick it up in the questions and answers in the seminar later. But I want to go to a completely different kind of social transformation. I want to go to the very political end, if you like. And I'm going to share with you a very, very intense situation. And although maybe there isn't, there are people who choose to step into these situations in this country. And if we were Tibetan or Burmese Buddhists, or we were in Vietnam in the 60s, we may have also been in these very, very intense political situations. So I'll just paint that as a backdrop. So these are very volatile situations and need a lot of maturity of practice. And they're very tough and emotionally draining situations. And although things can be a bit like I've described with Sue and Kevin, things on the weekends with the carers can kick off a bit. In other ways, it's quite hedonistic. You know, we're in the country, lots of lovely puddings and, you know, country houses. But this is the sort of really tough end. And I don't have a great deal of experience of it, but I have a bit. And I certainly have a lot of experience of being in dialogue with people who do this. Anyway, I'm going to read you the story of Lou in her own words. And this is an extract from an article from the Indra's Net magazine, which is a magazine part of the Network of Engaged Buddhists, which I'm quite involved in. I'll just read you the story. It's the grey, exhausted aftermath of the G20 demonstrations in London. Thousands of people have been out on the streets the previous day protesting at the Bank of England and the European Carbon Exchange. There was heavy police violence, and tired and battered bodies have been streaming into a squat near Liverpool Street station all night. It's a safe space. A team of us have set up a mobile kitchen in its basement. We feed hundreds of people bean chili and nettle dal and endless cups of tea. And while they rest, we stay up all night cleaning pots, supporting people, keeping the boiler going, doing what activist catering collectives do, creating safety and nourishment and order within chaos. Around 5 a.m., I snatch some sleep. The time stretches to noon, though it's hard to tell because the basement is dark and windowless. We manage a last pan of porridge and think about leaving. Most other people have left already, prompting a few listless meetings about the lack of people to protect the building. Then word begins to filter down that the police raid is coming. Tension builds as it becomes clear it's a big police raid, not police with an armoured vehicle, riot police with an armoured vehicle and tasers, which are sort of stun guns, which some of the police forces are equipped with now. Everyone else runs upstairs, but we stay to protect the catering equipment. The rest is a bit of a blur. We hear those upstairs being beaten. We wait, trapped in the basement, for them to find us. They burst through the doors with shields and batons and run towards us, shouting. Time stands still. I wait as they run towards me. Then I am spread-eagled on the floor, my face in the dust, my hands in cable ties. Someone is kneeling on my back. So she goes on then to describe being in Copenhagen and being at the front line of the clash between the demonstrators and the Danish police, which was quite violent. So she goes on. These were my experiences, and you may wonder where the Dharma is within such painful and violent interactions. I invite you to look at the gaps in the story. The Dharma is in the space as the police run across the basement floor towards me, batons raised. That is where the Dharma is. It's an experience of centered courage, of active nonviolence, of openness to the humanity of the perpetrators and our interconnectedness. I can remember little other than emotional traces, but what I can remember is a deep calm, a mindfulness of my own reactions, an unreactiveness, a resilience to the oppression. Mostly, the Dharma was there in a confidence, a certainty, that I did not need or want to respond violently. Their blows could not touch a strength that has grown over several years through the cultivation of meditation, awareness, and ecological sensitivity. Time spent on the cushion meant that as I lay face down on a concrete floor, I could feel at peace. I knew my heart mind was at my own, and their batons could not reach that. So those demonstrations and Lou's support of that through feeding people at the squat led to quite a big review, top to bottom in a way, going right up to Parliament, of the policing of protest, which is extremely important at the moment in terms of our space for social change. So how to support Lou? I'm involved in a retreat at Eco Dharma in a few weeks' time where Lou and her friends will be coming. And it's highly energetic and risky work. You know, this is the stretch. What can we offer here? That's the challenge. So, the last bit, and I do want to cover this, I've called it the self-referential novice bodhisattva. This is a third challenge. So, I feel stuck with a dilemma which I've wrestled with in writing this talk and almost any talk I do on this sort of subject. And it's something about feeling uneasy about placing personal practice in the context of altruistic work that can end up feeling a bit sort of holier than thou, or look at me being a good Buddhist or something. Or even if not that, then a fear of being seen to be doing that. So the fear of being seen to do that can close down dialogue and exploration. So it can be quite difficult to sort of go into the altruistic workers' practice area without ending up feeling a bit like you're sort of trying to sort of aggrandize yourself or something like that. So I went to talk to Bhante about this, and I referred to his poem, The Unseen Flower. And I'll read that to you now because it really captures what it is I'm wanting to aim at and not sort of feeling like sometimes I'm a bit going in the opposite direction. So here's the poem. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness, which is when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. Nobody, in fact, knows anything about it. If they knew it, it would not be compassion. But they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blooms in the heart of the void. So the dilemma is, how can we talk about this kind of work as practice and maintain the spirit of the unseen flower? So Bhante, by the way, was really interested in the Carers Project. He just asked me so many questions about it. He was really, really, you know, supportive and positive. And I don't know if he'd heard other people from other centres talking about it, but he sort of was as if he hadn't or something. But I mentioned... I was actually talking about a particular meditation practice that I was trying to do while listening to carers, but it's the same area. It's this, if you treat this kind of work as practice, it seems to bring in this clunky sort of self-referential element. But he was really encouraging, actually. He said it was a bit like learning to play a musical instrument, that when you're first learning the notes, you have to do it very consciously, and it feels a bit funny, and it doesn't flow. And then as you carry on and become more experienced, it becomes more fluent and fluid, and stops feeling so clunky, although I don't suppose that was a word he would use. So he's sort of saying carry on, and the self-conscious bit will kind of clear with practice, really. That's what he was saying, which I found incredibly helpful, really, really helpful. So, sort of seeing all of what I've said, really, in the context of the aim of this is to do it so spontaneously and naturally that you wouldn't have to sort of pick it all apart like I've been trying to do. But I think there is a value as a step in picking it apart. And then maybe you could, you know, once you've used that structure and analysis and sort of self-consciousness, then you can maybe let it go or something, I hope, anyway. So I'm going to close by reading The Unseen Flower again. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness, which is when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. Nobody, in fact, knows anything about it. If they knew it, it would not be compassion. But they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blooms in the heart of the void.